Do we line these walls with weapons and bar that door with death, lest anyone should come and hear Comrade Gregory saying to us, "Be good and you will be happy. Honesty is the best policy, and virtue is its own reward." There was not a word in Comrade Gregory's address to which a curate could not have listened with pleasure. Hear, hear. But I am not a curate. Loud cheers. And I did not listen to it with pleasure. Renewed cheers. The man who is fitted to make a good curate is not fitted to make a resolute, forcible, and efficient Thursday. Hear, hear. Comrade Gregory has told us in only too apologetic a tone that we are not the enemies of society. But I say that we are the enemies of society, and so much the worse for society. We are the enemies of society, for society is the enemy of humanity, its oldest and its most pitiless enemy. Hear, hear. Comrade Gregory has told us, apologetically again, that we are not murderers. There I agree. We are not murderers. We are executioners. Cheers. Ever since Syme had risen, Gregory had sat staring at him, his face idiotic with astonishment. Now, in the pause, his lips of clay parted, and he said, with an automatic and lifeless distinctness, "You damnable hypocrite." Syme looked straight into those frightful eyes with his own pale blue ones and said with dignity, "Comrade Gregory accuses me of hypocrisy. He knows as well as I do that I am keeping all my engagements and doing nothing but my duty. I do not mince words. I do not pretend to. I say that Comrade Gregory is unfit to be Thursday for all his amiable qualities. He is unfit to be Thursday because of his amiable qualities. We do not want the Supreme Council of Anarchy infected with a maudlin mercy." Hear, hear. "This is no time for ceremonial politeness. Neither is it time for ceremonial modesty. I set myself against Comrade Gregory as I would set myself against all the governments of Europe, because the anarchist who have given himself to anarchy has forgotten modesty as much as he has forgotten pride." Cheers. "I am not a man at all. I am a cause." Renewed cheers. "I set myself against Comrade Gregory as impersonally and as calmly as I should choose one pistol rather than another out of that rack upon the wall. And I say that rather than have Gregory and his milk and water methods on the Supreme Council, I would offer myself for election." His sentence was drowned in a deafening cataract of applause. The faces that had grown fiercer and fiercer with approval at his tirade grew more and more uncompromising, were now distorted with grins of anticipation or cloven with delighted cries. At the moment when he announced himself as ready to stand for the post of Thursday, a roar of excitement and assent broke forth and became uncontrollable, and at the same moment Gregory sprang to his feet with foam upon his mouth and shouted against the shouting. "Stop, you blasted madman," he cried at the top of a voice that tore his throat. "Stop, you!" But louder than Gregory's shouting and louder than the roar of the room came the voice of Syme, still speaking in a peal of pitiless thunder. "I do not go to the council to rebut that slander that calls us murderers. I go to earn it." Loud and prolonged cheering. "To the priest who says these men are the enemies of religion, to the judge who says these men are the enemies of law, to the fat parliamentarian who says these men are the enemies of order and public decency, to all these I will reply, you are false kings, but you are true prophets. I am come to destroy you and to fulfill your prophecies." The heavy glamour gradually died away, but before it had ceased, Witherspoon had jumped to his feet, his hair and beard all on end, and had said, "I move as an amendment that Comrade Syme be appointed to the post." "Stop all this, I tell you," cried Gregory with frantic face and hands. "Stop it. It is all..." The voice of the chairman clove his speech with a cold accent. "Does anyone second this amendment?" he said. A tall, tired man with melancholy eyes and an American chin beard was observed on the back bench to be slowly rising to his feet. Gregory had been screaming for some time past. Now there was a change in his assent, more shocking than any scream. I end all this, he said, in a voice as heavy as stone. This man cannot be elected. He is a... Yes, said Syme, quite motionless. What is he? Gregory's mouth worked twice without sound. Then slowly the blood began to crawl back into his dead face. He is a man quite inexperienced in our work, he said, and sat down abruptly. Before he had done so, the long, lean man with the American beard was again upon his feet and was repeating in a high American monotone, I beg to second the election of Comrade Syme. The amendment will, as usual, be put first, said Mr. Button, the chairman, with mechanical rapidity. The question is that Comrade Syme, Gregory had again sprung to his feet, panting and passionate. Comrades, he cried out, I am not a madman. Oh, said Mr. Witherspoon. I am not a madman, reiterated Gregory, with a frightful sincerity which for a moment staggered the room, but I give you a counsel which you can call mad if you like. No, I will not call it a counsel, for I can give you no reason for it. I will call it a command. Call it a mad command, but act upon it. Strike, but hear me. Kill me, but obey me. Do not elect this man. Truth is so terrible, even in fetters, that for a moment Syme's slender and insane victory swayed like a reed. But you could not have guessed it from Syme's bleak blue eyes. He merely began, Comrade Gregory commands. Then the spell was snapped, and one anarchist called out to Gregory, Who are you? You are not Sunday. And another anarchist added in a heavier voice, And you are not Thursday. Comrades, called Gregory in a voice like that of a martyr, who in an ecstasy of pain has passed beyond pain. It is nothing to me whether you detest me as a tyrant or detest me as a slave. If you will not take my command, accept my degradation. I kneel to you. I throw myself at your feet. I implore you, do not elect this man. Comrade Gregory, said the chairman after a painful pause, this is really not quite dignified. For the first time in the proceedings, there was a few seconds of real silence. Then Gregory fell back in his seat, a pale wreck of a man, and the chairman repeated, like a piece of clockwork suddenly started again. The question is that Comrade Syme be elected to the post of Thursday on the General Council. The roar rose like the sea, the hands rose like a forest, and 3 minutes afterwards Mr. Gabriel Syme, of the Secret Police Service, was elected to the post of Thursday on the General Council of the Anarchists of Europe. Everyone in the room seemed to feel the tug waiting on the river, the sword stick and the revolver waiting on the table. The instant the election was ended and irrevocable, and Syme had received the paper proving his election, they all sprang to their feet, and the fiery groups moved and moved in the room. Syme found himself somehow or other face to face with Gregory, who still regarded him with a stare of stunned hatred. They were silent for many minutes. "You are a devil," said Gregory at last. And you are a gentleman, said Syme with gravity. It was you that entrapped me, began Gregory, shaking from head to foot. Entrapped me into... Talk sense, said Syme shortly. Into what sort of devil's parliament have you entrapped me, if it comes to that? You made me swear before I made you. Perhaps we are both doing what we think right. But what we think right is so damn different that there can be nothing between us in the way of concession. There is nothing possible between us but honor and death. And he pulled the great cloak about his shoulders and picked up the flask from the table. The boat is quite ready, said Mr. Buttons, bustling up. Be good enough to step this way. With a gesture that revealed the shopwalker, he led Syme down a short, iron-bound passage, the still agonized Gregory following feverishly at their heels. At the end of the passage was a door which Buttons opened sharply, showing a sudden blue and silver picture of the moonlit river that looked like a scene in a theater. Close to the opening lay a dark, dwarfish steam launch with a baby dragon with one red eye. Almost in the act of stepping on board, Gabriel Syme turned to the gaping Gregory. You have kept your word, he said gently, with his face in shadow. You are a man of honor, and I thank you. You have kept it even down to a small particular. There was one special thing you promised me at the beginning of the fair, and which you've certainly given me by the end of it. What do you mean? Cried the chaotic Gregory. What did I promise you? A very entertaining evening, said Syme, and he made a military salute with the sword stick as the steamboat slid away. Chapter 4. The Tale of a Detective. Gabriel Syme was not merely a detective who pretended to be a poet. He was really a poet who had become a detective. Nor was his hatred of anarchy hypocritical. He was one of those who are driven early in life into too conservative an attitude by the bewildering folly of most revolutionists. He had not attained it by any tame tradition. His respectability was spontaneous and sudden, a rebellion against rebellion. He came of a family of cranks in which all the oldest people had all the newest notions. One of his uncles always walked about without a hat, and another had made an unsuccessful attempt to walk about without a hat, and nothing else. His father cultivated art and self-realization. His mother went in for simplicity and hygiene. Hence the child, during his tenderer years, was wholly unacquainted with any drink between the extremes of absinthe and cocoa, of both of which he had a healthy dislike. The more his mother preached a more than Puritan abstinence, the more did his father expand into a more than pagan latitude, and by the time the former had come to enforcing vegetarianism, the latter had pretty well reached the point of defending cannibalism. Being surrounded with every conceivable kind of revolt from infancy, Gabriel had to revolt into something. So he revolted into the only thing left, sanity. But there was just enough in him of the blood of these fanatics to make even his protest for common sense a little too fierce to be sensible. His hatred of modern lawlessness had been crowned also by an accident. It happened that he was walking in a side street at the instant of a dynamite outrage. He had been blind and deaf for a moment and then seen the smoke clearing, the broken windows, and the bleeding faces. After that he went about as usual, quiet, courteous, rather gentle, but there was a spot on his mind that was not sane. He did not regard anarchists, as most of us do, as a handful of morbid men combining ignorance with intellectualism. He regarded them as a huge and pitiless peril, like a Chinese invasion. He poured perpetually into newspapers and their waste paper baskets a torrent of tales, verses, and violent articles, warning men of this deluge of barbaric denial. But he seemed to be getting no nearer his enemy, and what was worse, no nearer a living. As he paced the Thames Embankment, bitterly biting a cheap cigar and brooding on the advance of anarchy, there was no anarchist with a bomb in his pocket, so savage or so solitary as he. Indeed, he always felt that government stood alone and desperate, with its back to the wall. He was too pathetic to have cared for it otherwise. He walked on that embankment once under a dark red sunset. The red river reflected the red sky, and they both reflected his anger. The sky indeed was so swarthy, and the light on the river relatively so lurid, that the water almost seemed a fiercer flame than the sunset it mirrored. It looked like a stream of literal fire winding under the vast caverns of a subterranean country. Syme was shabby in those days. He wore an old-fashioned black chimney-pot hat. He was wrapped in a yet more old-fashioned cloak, black and ragged, and the combination gave him the look of the early villains in Dickens and Bulwer Lytton. Also his yellow beard and hair were more unkempt and leonine than when they appeared long afterwards, cut and pointed, on the lawns of Saffron Park. A long, lean, black cigar, bought in Soho for twopence, stood out from between his tightened teeth, and altogether he looked a very satisfactory specimen of the anarchist upon whom he had vowed a holy war. Perhaps this was why a policeman on the embankment spoke to him and said, "Good evening." Syme, at a crisis of his morbid fears of humanity, seemed stung by the mere solidity of the automatic official, a mere bulk of blue in the twilight. "A good evening, is it?" he said sharply. "You fellows would call the end of the world a good evening. Look at that bloody red sun and that bloody river. I tell you that if that were literally human blood, spilt and shining, you would still be standing here as solid as ever, looking out for some poor harmless tramp whom you could move on. You policemen are cruel to the poor, but I could forgive you even your cruelty if it were not for your calm." "If we are calm," replied the policeman, "it is the calm of organized resistance." "Eh?" said Syme, staring. "The soldier must be calm in the thick of battle," pursued the policeman. "The composure of an army is the anger of a nation." "Good God, the board school," said Syme. "Is this undenominational education?" "No," said the policeman sadly. "I never had any of those advantages. The board schools came after my time." "What education I had was very rough and old-fashioned, I'm afraid." "Where did you have it?" asked Syme, wondering. "Oh, at Harrow," said the policeman. The class sympathies, which, false as they are the truest things in so many men, broke out of Syme before he could control them. "But good Lord, man," he said, "you oughtn't to be a policeman." The policeman sighed and shook his head. "I know," he said solemnly. "I know. I'm not worthy." "But why did you join the police?" asked Syme with crude curiosity. "For much the same reason that you abused the police," replied the other. "I found that there was a special opening in the service for those whose fears for humanity were concerned rather with the aberrations of the scientific intellect than with the normal and excusable, though excessive, outbreaks of the human will. I trust I make myself clear." "If you mean that you make your opinion clear," said Syme, "I suppose you do. But as for making yourself clear, it is the last thing you do. How comes a man like you to be talking philosophy in a blue helmet on the Thames Embankment?" "You have evidently not heard of the latest development in our police system," replied the other. "I am not surprised at it. We are keeping it rather dark from the educated class, because that class contains most of our enemies. But you seem to be exactly in the right frame of mind. I think you might almost join us." "Join you in what?" asked Syme. "I will tell you," said the policeman slowly. "This is the situation. The head of one of our departments, one of the most celebrated detectives in Europe, has long been of opinion that a purely intellectual conspiracy would soon threaten the very existence of civilization. He is certain that the scientific and artistic worlds are silently bound in a crusade against the family and the state. He has, therefore, formed a special corps of policemen who are also philosophers. It is their business to watch the beginnings of this conspiracy, not merely in a criminal, but in a controversial sense. I am a Democrat myself, and I am fully aware of the value of the ordinary man in matters of ordinary valor or virtue. But it would obviously be undesirable to employ the common policeman in an investigation which is also a heresy hunt." Syme's eyes were bright with a sympathetic curiosity. "What do you do, then?" he said. "The work of the philosophical policeman," replied the man in blue, "is at once bolder and more subtle than that of the ordinary detective. The ordinary detective goes to pothouses to arrest thieves. We go to artistic tea parties to detect pessimists. The ordinary detective discovers from a ledger or a diary that a crime has been committed. We discover from a book of sonnets that a crime will be committed. We have to trace the origin of those dreadful thoughts that drive men on, at last, to intellectual fanaticism and intellectual crime. We were only just in time to prevent the assassination at Hartwell Pool, and that was entirely due to the fact that our Mr. Wilkes, a smart young fellow, thoroughly understood a triolet." "Do you mean," asked Syme, "that there is really as much connection between crime and the modern intellect as all that?" You are not sufficiently democratic, answered the policeman. But you were right when you said just now that our ordinary treatment of the poor criminal was a pretty brutal business. I tell you, I am sometimes sick of my trade when I see how perpetually it means merely a war upon the ignorant and the desperate.